Welcome to This Is Not About Your Body, where we talk about all the real shit body image issues are actually about, because they're never just about the way you look. I'm your host, Jesse Nealon, and today I have with me Brina Jean, who is a self-identified fat, black, queer engineer who was diagnosed with stage 4 lipedema at 38 years old. She is now a storyteller, speaker, and lipedema advocate who creates content that teaches, inspires, and gives a spotlight to underrepresented folks. And I've been following and loving Brina's content on Instagram for a long time, so I'm really excited to finally have her on here. Welcome, Brina.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Okay, so I'm going to just start, because we're going to be referencing lipedema here quite a bit in the beginning part of this conversation. And I'd love to get, for anyone who's not familiar with this condition, a little bit of insight into what that is and what that means.
I think I want to start with saying what it's not, because it gets confused quite a bit. If you have lipedema and you've gone to your doctor about it, you have definitely experienced lipedema being confused with lymphedema. They are not the same. They can be related, but they are not the same. They are very different. Lots of people think that they don't have lipedema because their doctors have told them you don't have lymphedema.
Huh?
They're mixing up the two. So lipedema, L-I-P-E-D-E-M-A, is a connective tissue disorder that breaks the lymphatic system, causing limbs to grow fairly large due to leaky lymph coming out of the lymphatic system. So lymph is the fluid that flows throughout the lymphatic system, right? It's supposed to be absorbed into that system and, you know, fit throughout the body. But a broken lymphatic system by connective tissue disorder means that the housing for lymph is shabby. And so it can be leaky, and that fluid can congeal to some extent and become hardened. And it looks nothing like fat, is what surgeons have said when they remove it. Huh. It looks more like scar tissue. And the scar tissue can collect into the limbs primarily. And in the later stages, it can spread into other places like the stomach, the breast, the back, the flanks, the buttocks. Essentially, it can be pretty much anywhere, even at the bottom of your face. I haven't heard of a lot of people having it in their head, but certainly in the face, I've been told. So about 30% of the people who have lipedema have it in both their legs and their arms primarily. And then in the later stages, it can again go out into other places. The late stage, stage 4, which is what I have, can cause lymphedema secondarily. And that's how the two are related. So stage 4, they say, is lipolymphedema, and that is the presence of lipedema, that scarified tissue that causes that widespread inflammation and tenderness, plus lymphedema, which is a blockage in the lymphatic system that causes swelling.
Okay, thank you. That was very thorough. And I also just want to point out, you just taught me this a few minutes ago when we were chatting, that you said 1 in 9 people who are assigned female at birth have lipedema, which is very high for something that I think has such low representation.
Right. So lipedema is not a rare disorder. It's not a rare disease. It is rarely diagnosed. And that's the difference. It's a very common disorder that mostly impacts folks assigned female at birth. But I know of people who are assigned male at birth who have this as well. Yeah. I follow a couple of influencers, or at least one that has it. And you know, he exists. Yeah. So, but it is not a rare disorder. It is a very common disorder. Folks who have struggled getting diagnosed with this and have done the obsessive comparison of their body to folks who don't have this, you know, we've looked at bodies and limbs so much that we can see it on the street just like that. I see it every day. I see it all the time. And I don't know whether to like, hey, I think you might have this fully diagnosed condition that they call a fat disorder. You know, I don't know whether to approach people or not. And I've in the past said we shouldn't do that, but I wonder if that does a disservice. I'm open to being wrong. I'm open to all the time about this because I don't know what I'm doing, but see it all the time.
So your eyes are now trained to notice the signs And I think what's really important is that to an untrained eye, it will often just, actually, even maybe to some eyes that really should be trained in the medical system, it will often just read as what?
Obesity,
Like obesity.
what they call obesity,
Just
large.
bigness equals fatness. You're just fat.
Yeah, but I don't want to overlook is thin people can have lipedema too. My mother was
Right.
45 pounds, which may not be thin to some folks. She was 5'5", but to me, she was thin. Okay,
Yeah.
she was small. She was a normal size person, or whatever you
Sure.
want to call that. But she had lipedema and she was never diagnosed in her lifetime, but she had all the symptoms. And I didn't realize it until after she passed away and I got diagnosed. I said, oh my gosh, the pain, the swelling,
Right.
her upset. My mother worked out. She ran track. She worked out all the time and she never, that body weight never came down. Yeah. And we didn't, you know, we didn't have the same body. My mother had a more acceptable body in the Black community, at least. She had a very small waist and she had very wide hips and thick thighs and a bottom, you know, which is, you know, she was very confident in her body. She thought she was hot stuff and she was, you know, the community let her know, you know. So in no way would she had ever thought, I have a fat disorder, I have a connective tissue disorder.
Ah,
She would never thought that. And there are lots of people that we see, honey, there are video vixens that make sense. I'm like, oh, they call that two body syndrome when the top of the body is really, really small and then the bottom half of the body is much larger. You often see it in people who've had weight loss surgery where all of their weight will come down off the top of their bodies, but their legs will remain large. They're not, you know, I think the part that I missed saying when I was defining this is lipedema is resistant to diet and exercise, cannot burn it off.
Right, because it's not it you
It's not
said it's
metabolic.
not actually fat tissue, right?
It's scarified tissues. It's
Yeah.
scar tissue. When the brain sends a signal to the body to burn off fat for energy, scar tissue doesn't respond to that. It doesn't
Right.
message and go, okay, let's go. You know, it's not useful as far as energy goes. It's non-metabolic. So you
Yeah.
can lose metabolic fat, but you cannot lose non-metabolic masses. And we do not have the technology to determine how much of someone's body, if they have lipedema, consists of non-metabolic fat and metabolic fat, or non-metabolic mass and non-metabolic
Oh.
mass. So when you look at someone, you can't go, oh, you have lipedema, but you at least could lose a good 100 or so pounds of metabolic. We
That's
can't tell.
interesting to not be able to know. I assume until maybe like you're in there with a scalpel, there's no.
No,
Because a major part of the shame and stigma that I have seen when I've worked with clients in this space is that, in part because it's so underrepresented, misunderstood, and misdiagnosed, is that they just feel like failures. They'll be dieting or exercising or whatever and not losing the weight and just feel really like they're doing something wrong, feel really ashamed when they get the diagnosis. That can sometimes actually be really liberating to be like, oh, it's because it's not metabolic like fat tissue. That's
When
it
I was
totally changes it.
diagnosed, I screamed and cried and ran. You thought something traumatic had happened. It was because all of the mind fuckery.
Right.
And, you know, I'm a person who is an opportunistic, anorexic. You know, I've experienced, you know, I was a avid spit chewer, which, you know, just chewing, spitting, and, you know, not swallowing.
Yeah, okay.
I struggle with eating disorders. Trigger warning, maybe.
Sure. No,
Maybe.
that's okay. In this podcast, everybody, I think, kind of knows what they're getting
Yeah,
into,
we know.
but I didn't know that part of your story, so I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of people. I just did a talk with Jordalyn Hall, I think their name is, about how many people with lipedema, it's almost like a pipeline to eating disorders
Of
because
course.
if you are not diagnosed and you're going to the doctor, and you are overweight, your doctor is going to mention your weight and not only mention it, but also tell you every comorbidity that could happen if you don't lose weight, which
Right.
includes death and dying, which your entire community echoes back at you. Fat
Yeah.
people are spoken about death more than anything, anyone
Right.
else in the world, right? I was just told yesterday that I was gonna die on Instagram. It's a regular
Oh my
occurrence,
God.
people speaking death over
Yeah.
folks. And with all of that, you know, you're probably going to be doing everything that you can to try to prevent what your doctor, this person who has a very high place in society. They have an authority, you know, they are an authority on health. You respect, there's a lot of respectability politics that goes in line with, you know, your relationship with your doctors. So you're probably going to be doing every single thing you could possibly do to change your weight. And guess what? If you have lipedema, you're not going to be successful. And, you know, that cycle of trying and trying and trying and failing and failing and failing only leads people to more extreme routes. So it's kind of like the experience of living with lipedema undiagnosed is a pipeline to a lot of misery and a lot of harm that folks end up doing to themselves.
Makes so much sense. Also, you got diagnosed pretty late. How long, is this like a lifetime disorder? Like, are you born with it? Did you have it a long time? Would you say there was a time that you noticed it?
Yeah, so most people right now who are diagnosed are not diagnosed early on in their life. It is a rare experience to be diagnosed early on. However, the more we talk about it on social media where young people are, the more young people are getting diagnosed. And it just warms my heart that they get to have this, you know, that cycle interrupted early. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't diagnosed until I was about 38 years old. I started noticing the symptoms of lipedema when I was around 11 years old.
Oh, wow. That is a long time.
A long time. And it was when I began to have this relationship with my body where I saw myself as being non-normative because my legs looked different. It really wasn't my arms until much later, but I noticed I had this lobule on the inside of my legs, right where my knee meets my thigh.
Will you give us a definition of lobule, please?
That's a really tough one. It's more of a visual thing. I call it a lobule. It's a cuff. I wish my arms were exposed, but it's a mass of hanging flesh. It looks like a little sack. And many people with lipedema have these sacs in different places. And that's probably the thing I'm most insecure about. And a lot of us are most insecure about.
Of course.
It makes us feel gross that these lobules can form. Some people have them on their hips. Some people have them on their thighs. Some people have them, like me, on their arms and on their flanks, which is primarily where I have these lobules. And they're, for me, full of this nodular texture. Some people use a bag of frozen peas to describe the texture of lipedema. It can be a little misleading because that leads you to believe that, oh, it's really small beads. It can be really small beads, but I have thumb size beads that I can grasp with my fingers, you know? Skin is very thin due to a comorbidity I have of lipedema called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which can come along with lipedema. They're both connective tissue disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Very stretchy skin. I've talked about that sometimes. But I can feel, I'm a really good study for this because of the thin skin. It's like you can see the nodules through my skin almost. And it looks, people would mistake it for cellulite, but it's not cellulite, especially if you can grab it. If you can grab it with a finger and isolate a nodule, that's not going to be cellulite, you know? And if it's tender and you have the different shapes, if you have a lot of these symptoms that come along with lipedema, then you can pretty much tell the difference between cellulite and this. But when I was 11 is when I first started to become self-conscious about what I thought was different from other people's. I was obsessed with people's legs on the playground. I would stare at the other kids' legs because I was like, my legs aren't doing this thing. My legs aren't tapering like these other folks. My legs, you know, they stop tapering and I get lumps here and bumps here, and I have cellulite at 11, and I just felt really monstrous as a kid. And I used to wear a uniform. I went to private school. I'm from East Oakland, but I went to private school there in East Oakland. And I started to, on hot days, started to cover, you know, that's when my modesty started. I started wearing really long shorts, which for a second you could get away with during the 90s because cross color. But eventually that phase like went away, but I still wore those really long shorts trying to cover that lobule over my knee during the summer. And then it just became a thing where I would just wear layers and layers of clothes trying to cover myself. And the elders, thin elders, would say, just lose some weight and you'll feel better about your body. And the plus size elders would say, ain't nothing wrong with you. You're beautiful, right? Which both are not really addressing the concern.
Right.
But thank goodness for those plus size elders, because I really did need a lot of validation
Right.
at that time. And so I got validation in of beauty, but I didn't get validation of my concerns about what was going on with the non-normative parts of my body that I saw.
Yeah. So I want to point out that, like, I mean, really anything that feels non-normative is going to be, scrutinized, marginalized. It's going to cause all kinds of issues in terms of how people perceive you or you perceive yourself. Certainly with diet culture, weight stigma, fat phobia, all of these things, just having a bigger body would, that is enough. We know that that is enough to cause a lot of these issues as well. But that even inside of what we're like moving very half-assedly into a, like a body positivity for plus size people as a culture, we are seeing still just representations of what would be like a sort of perfect tapered hourglass, but bigger. That's what's okay to be in a larger body. That's what's being represented for the most part. I mean, certain brands are like creeping, crawling their way into more representation. But what you're describing is not just a body size thing, it is a body shape thing. And that is, I would say, almost never represented positively or in media.
Yeah, you're right. We do. One of the things that keeps people undiagnosed, I'm speaking slowly because I'm thinking hard about
Yeah.
this, and I'm not exactly sure I'm right. But from the stories, I'm a story person. From the stories that I've heard of people's diagnosis and people's experiences who have lipedema, one of the things that helped keep it secret was not seeing it. Right? Like,
Right.
literally, we're hiding these parts of our bodies when we're out in the world. We're hiding our legs. That was part of, I learned how to dress well and
Yeah.
hide everything, right? and we're not seeing it represented in media much,
Right.
not seeing these bodies enough means that we don't. I noticed that people don't know see the difference in fat bodies. They just assume every fat body is shaped the same way.
Right.
And I'm like, no, fat people are shaped incredibly different.
Yeah.
Look at us. Some people are top heavy, some people are bottom heavy, some people are hourglass, some with a flat stomach, and some
Yeah.
people have these big bellies, some people have big penises that hang down to their knees, but we don't want to look at them.
Yeah.
People don't want to look at them. And so if you don't want to see something, you don't even learn the differences between all the bodies, right?
Right.
And so I realized also that I needed to see bodies like mine when I was 11. And back then, you didn't see anyone that looked anything like me
Yeah.
anywhere, Anywhere at all.
I don't know. I mean, I occasionally see like, influencers that I follow with diverse shapes and sizes of bodies occasionally get little brand deals and I celebrate. But like I still in the mainstream, I don't think we
Yeah.
are.
It occurred to me in this experience of learning that I had lipedema and what it was and how many people had it. It occurred to me, like, the Pedagogy of the Oppressed, that book. There's a line in there that says something about if you liberate the most oppressed person, then everyone who's less oppressed than that person will also experience liberation from their margins. And I thought that the most oppressed person was obviously going to be a Black, trans, disabled person, maybe non-binary, right? Who appeared trans, appeared to be in transition and up. And then it occurred to me when I realized that there are people hiding from visibility who are so non-normative that they hide from visibility, that I have to add that into the intersection of most oppressed person. And so I'm consciously walking around now going, there are people that you do not see.
Right.
There are people that you will not see. There are people existing that are hiding from visibility.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting to think that, like, in order to hide from a very particular kind of visibility, that the disguise is basically fatness, which is another marginalized identity. It's like hiding inside of an already marginalized identity to avoid a more marginalized identity. And of course, if people aren't looking for it, they're not going to see it. So it just, yeah, I totally see how that completely gets erased and is invisible.
Yeah. There are people who are much more non-normative than I am, who we just absolutely do not see and have not seen, you know, and are intentionally trying to stay out of our view because of the experiences that they have when they are viewed, when they're seen.
Now, I want to make sure I understand, because my assumption when you first said this was like folks with lipedema hiding their bodies. Do you mean something else, or do you have other examples of what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think people with, I definitely know people with lipedema are definitely hiding, because I'm in groups, I talk to y'all. I know that some of y'all have, I barely leave my house, okay? I know, I barely leave my house for lots of reasons, accessibility reasons, being perceived reasons. But I definitely know that there are people who I've been called pretty from the neck up, right? And there are definitely people who are disfigured from the neck up, or non-normative from the neck up.
Yes,
these people
understood.
Are, you know, and I think about people who have many variations of non-normativity throughout the body, not just from the neck up, but all throughout the body.
Yeah.
And I think I can assume, based on the experiences and stories I have of people who are like me, that if we hid a little bit, then there are definitely some people who are hiding a lot more.
Understood. Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So speaking of hiding, one of the things in your social media content, one of the like sort of delightful through lines that I've seen over however long, is your journey to stop hiding your legs, to become the representation and visibility that you needed to see when you were growing up, and to be just sort of out there for the greater good, which I love. But it does sound like you've also found your own peace inside of yourself. And I'm curious to hear what that feels like or looks like for you. But tell us about the experience of not hiding. Like, how was that, especially at first?
It was terrifying.
Like, first time you wore shorts.
It was
calm, chill day.
No, it was really, the process was very intentional. And by intentional, I mean, like, I'm aware that I am terrified and that this is terrifying, right? And I'm doing it in a very controlled way. I'm not going to my job's office, you know, like in a short dress, in a mini skirt.
Right.
Which I still don't know if I can do.
I was like, would you do that now?
I still don't know if I could do it myself. I think they would be like, yeah, all for it. But be like, but I started to take photos of myself, and parts of my body. I started to look at up close, which I really hadn't done. I hadn't had a full length mirror in my own apartment my entire life up until right after I was diagnosed. And now I have, you know, a full length mirror that I look in quite regularly. I wasn't looking at myself until after diagnosis. Because I was looking at my legs like, you're supposed to look away. Why don't you look this way?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But now that I know, oh, you're not supposed to look that way.
Yeah.
I know why you look this way now. Leg, you know?
Yeah.
Arm, cuffs on my wrist. I get it. I get you now. I knew that. And again, I wasn't looking at my body because I assumed I did whatever I did to my body to make it look this way and that I should be ashamed. That was the narrative that was running through my mind.
Of
and
course.
So I was avoiding my own shame, right? Yeah. I was avoiding my own shame, which a lot of shame is a big, big, just tack it across my forehead. That is, it comes along with lipedema when you are not diagnosed.
Yeah.
And getting diagnosed, getting the validation that you're not living in sin, you know, you're not this person who is living in sin, who's doing something to their bodies that people are condemning and, you know, shaming you for. And so that's when I began to look at my body, when I realized that I didn't do anything and was constantly doing something wrong.
Yeah.
And once that got out of the way, I could see my body, and I started to experiment with, can I go out into the world with parts of my body exposed that I previously felt like responsible for the shame that people projected onto me? Can I support myself through experiencing other people experiencing me? And some days it was like, hell no,
Totally.
and I began to be very conscious of the 11-year-old Brina who needed to see me so fucking bad, man, who needed to eradicate, because that's when the shame started. I was 11 years old when I was taught to be not just shameful of my appearance, but shameful of what I was doing to make myself look this way,
Yeah,
right?
can you even imagine if just like multiple women in your community wore shorts and that's just how their legs looked at 11?
I
And it was
know.
just like, yeah, that's like a thing sometimes.
It's like, yeah, that's a thing sometimes, right? I can't imagine actually how my life would be totally different. How my mind would be totally different.
How
But
old were you, by the way? So this was like right after diagnosis that you started
okay, I was
fear
39.
facing.
And there's something about turning about to be 40. There's something about the about to be 40 that's just like,
Yeah. As
no.
a woman, you're like just about to get out, you know, like you're not allowed to wear shorts anymore anyway. If you're any other identity,
All these rules
shorts are
about,
supposed to be done, and here you are being like, so no.
yeah, about shorts, about shorts, about dresses, about
Oh, I love it.
showing my legs above the knee. It was interesting because I didn't hide. Like when I was young, I got a tattoo on my arm, and my arms were big, and I didn't really hide my I hid my arms every now and then, but I was like, I got a tattoo, I'm badass, like
Love that.
look at my tattoo. And I thought it was, and I saw how people would react to my arm tattoos, and they were like, they would speak beautifully about my arms, and I really like that. I really and I thought I was like, I'm gonna get tattoos everywhere. Be careful with tattoos if you have lipedema, because if you have lipolymphedema and you do not know it, you can cause an infection, you can become sepsis can kill you. That is the high risk of having lipedema and lipolymphedema, is that sepsis is a very real thing because our
Understood.
lymphatic systems are not working to manage infections very well.
You can't
Just want to
even
put that out there.
decorate if that's what
I
you want to
know.
do.
I was told by Dr. Iker, she was like, no more tattoos. And I was like, no. But I'm glad I got my quarter sleeve. It's not a real sleeve, but people would look at my arms and they would ask me about my tattoo and not my arms. And I'd be like, And I realized I showed my arms a lot more than my legs. I never showed my thighs. I was so afraid. Oh, I was so afraid of somebody to see my thighs. I was terrified. We used to go swimming all the time. And when I was a kid, I went swimming all the time. Ask me how I went swimming
How did you go swimming?
in a full outfit. I
Oh my
swam in an
God.
entire outfit, a shirt and shorts with a swimsuit under. Why was I even wearing a swimsuit under it? It was in shorts that went down to right under my knees.
Oh,
Every
wow.
single I swam every single day. I love swimming. That's another thing. Swimming is very comforting to folks with lipedema. That's a whole nother thing.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you wear now if you go swimming now?
Oh, I wear a two-piece.
I love
I do. And sometimes I leave my house in the two-piece and just, I drive in my car with a swimsuit,
Oh my God.
and people go through whatever they need to go through to,
Oh my
experience me.
God. Okay, so that's a really major piece of the journey that I hear and I think is important, basically, no matter what kind of fear facing a person has to do in terms of basically wanting to become the representation and or overcome their own shame for whatever it was that they learned they should feel shame about. Fear facing, it's a huge thing. It's a huge part of the work that I do with my clients. And sometimes I'll call it death work because it literally your nervous system responds. Like if I were to go out in a tank top or shorts or whatever, like my whole community would abandon me and I would end up dead. And
Yeah.
I think it's so important not to minimize that. Like, because people say, oh, I don't know why I'm so scared. It's just a piece of clothing. And I'm like, I do.
Yeah. You
Evolutionary science does.
Yeah. Good reasons to be terrified.
But one of the things that happens is as you shift accountability, like it, you know, the two things feed into each other. The more you do something scary, the less scary it becomes. You kind of trust yourself to like handle the consequences. The other thing is you start to realize there's a difference between the shame people are projecting onto you and your actual agreement to hold that shame, right? So at a certain point, you can see other people spiraling. They could be having a meltdown about your body, and you're not involved in the drama because you have decided not to hold that drama and the shame and the anxiety and whatever it might be, right? Like,
Can I interrupt you right there?
please do, yes.
Yeah. So this is, and I feel like we're going to get into the body neutrality piece that
Yeah.
we've been talking about because of that. Because it's not that I've decided. It's not that I've decided.
Okay.
I've been given a reason. I've been given an explanation. I've been given a truth. I understand where their ignorance comes from. They don't know anything about lipedema, and they've been indoctrinated into the dangers of being fat. They have an ideology
Right.
that hasn't been undone. I understand. I empathize with where
Yeah.
their fear and hatred come from. Also, a lot of these people that spiral are spiraling because they've had traumatic experiences losing fat people that they love in their lives, and they've lost those fat people for reasons that are very unclear. They believe they've lost them because of the ideologies that they've been indoctrinated into holding up, but they've actually lost them because of the inadequacies of the healthcare system into caring for fat people. No, they have, and then fat people have such little power that when we tell them that, they don't believe it. The ideology is bigger than the truth. That's the mechanism that allows me to not internalize the shame that they're projecting is my empathy for their loss, their grief, their experience, and their indoctrination.
Okay, so that's really beautiful. And to my listeners, I want to demonstrate that we now have two paths you can take to overcome shame. You can choose my path, which I'm realizing right in this very moment is a sort of disconnect from empathy at times, where I'm like, ooh, I want to like fuck somebody up a little bit. If they're going to try and project shame on me for something, I'm like, ooh, go for it. Yeah, definitely coming from a different place. I think when I use the word decide, that probably aligns a little bit more with some of the experiences I've had, some of my client experiences of basically choosing not to. Like, let's say it were slut shaming or something like that. It's like, I have decided that that no longer holds a moral significance for me. And if it does for you, like, I'm happy to fuck your life up a little bit by just existing. So that is my tack. Yours is gorgeous in its compassion, empathy, and like truly kindness and sensitivity. And I can totally see how that would end up taking you where you need to go as well.
But it requires the truth, you know. I
Yeah.
think my way requires the truth, and that's very difficult. It's very difficult for people to look at us in the complexities and nuances of how we really exist in a hierarchical society, right? Where
Yeah.
certain where we have intersections, multiple of them, and they shape and change our life from each other, right?
Yeah.
We live inside of our biases. And the only way to know what's outside of our biases is to take in information from other people who,
Yeah.
in a hierarchical system, may have more or less power than we do. And then there are these ideologies that fuck with that. So, like, I can hold all that nuance. Not everyone can, and I respect that. I have
Yeah.
friends that are just like, no, I can't. I can't. My brain is tired, right? But I can hold a lot of nuance, and I get that I have privilege in that way. And for me, the way that I learn, I have to know the mechanisms. I'm an engineer. I have to know the
Sure.
mechanisms that exist in a structure.
Yeah.
And the truth, when I know the tr when it, when you know the truth, when you know that most likely these angry people have been hurt, and they're living out in a
Yeah.
traumatized way, and they're traumatizing other people with their trauma. Okay. I don't have to be
Yeah.
traumatized. I don't have to. I don't have to. I know the truth, and I can sit with it.
It's so true. And it's interesting you say that because I actually feel like there are some aspects that I connect to that much more easily and readily. And interestingly, they're probably like I have so much body privilege. And I think it's probably the ways that push me the furthest outside of that bubble that is actually where I can connect to the most nuance and empathy. For example, like transphobia, because I'm non-binary and trans, and like that to me, you'd sort of think maybe that'd be the place I'd have the least empathy, like fuck everybody. But I'm actually like, I get it. In part because it took me nearly 4 decades to even name it, because I had that too, right? Like I have so much empathy for that confusion, for that disgust, for all that stuff, because I'm like, I was up in that same mindset until like, you know, yesterday. So yeah, that's interesting to hear.
Yeah. And I think there's a part of me that's like, I get it. I hated the fuck out of my existence.
Right.
I was so confused about me. I was so confused about me. The 11-year-old was confused. The 20-year-old was confused. I stayed confused right. for years about me. And because of that confusion, hated existing in this world. And it wasn't until the confusion got ironed out yep. that I was like, oh my gosh, I can make sense of things now. My body makes sense.
Yes, that makes so much sense.
My body makes sense. I can see how I'm stunning now, right? Yes. Like I can see how I stun people.
Okay, so this is one of my questions for you. So you posted about being stunning, and it just as like a writer, I don't know, it just makes me so happy to hear this word being used, because we often think of it as a synonym for like beautiful, which of course it totally can be. And we don't think about it being a synonym for like dangerous, like sort of alarming almost. And it absolutely is. So yeah, it tell is. Me more about your use of the word stunning and the way that you apply it to yourself.
I wish I had the word when I was 11, because I didn't identify with pretty, and I still don't really identify with pretty. Some people will be like, oh my gosh, you have such a pretty face, but they will isolate the face, you know, in totality. In totality, I don't align with what society calls pretty. I don't fit into the category of pretty societally, if you want to use societals, you know, measurements as for that, you know, but I don't. My experience in the world is not a pretty one. I don't have a pretty experience in the world. That's just the truth. But I do have a stunning one, right? Because I do have a pretty face and I have an alarming body, and together they confuse and stun and intrigue and repulse. And people experience me in such dramatic ways. And I'm glad, like I needed that when I was a teenager, because you know, people, adults, they try. They try to work through their shit and go, well, you have such a pretty face. You know, that's what they tell you. That's how they want to digest you.
Oh, man. The word of itself.
But I think if someone were to tell me that I had been stunning my whole life, it would have made so much sense to my experience.
Right.
Because you think as a kid, as a teenager, and even as an adult, sometimes you think if you're not pretty, you're not anything as a person assigned female at birth.
Right.
Yeah.
And we are given several categories. You can be cute. Cute is an option, sort of like an infantile or like nubile pretty. Right. You can be sexy or hot, which is like, you know, sort of the other side of the virginal whore spectrum of pretty. And beautiful is pretty neutral. Pretty is kind of neutral. We don't have a lot of options outside of childish, sexed up, or just sort of like neutral, conventionally attractive. Yeah. We don't have many other words.
Yeah. And to be honest, the word came after I'd had a wonderful relationship with a very sexy queer who I didn't really, you know, I'm sure many fat people have had this sort of reckoning, I guess, with people who are interested in them. Why the hell are you attracted to me? What are you attracted to? You know, and it comes off as so insecure, but I really want to understand how you see me, because again, I interact with so many responses to me and none of them are willing to love me, right? Why are you here? You know, and then, which is really, this is a whole nother conversation. It was also the first time that I'd ever been engaged in anything remotely like polyamory, but it's the only time, but in seeing them be attracted to other people, I was like, oh, you like people who shock people.
What a unique insight.
You are,
Like,
yeah, to
yeah.
be able to see them being attracted to other people and to be at peace with it,
Uh-huh.
right? When all of the other shit is out of the way, you know,
Yeah.
you're like, you could really like take in an experience that someone else is having. I was like, oh, you are I have something in common with the other people that you're attracted to. And I was like, what's the word? What's the word? It's stunning.
I love that.
You are attracted to stunning people. And then I was like, I'm stunning.
Yes.
I stun people. I'm a big, fat, black, bald woman with a pretty face and a
Yes.
non-normative body.
Yes, it's like traffic stopping. That's like the perfect, yes.
Yeah. And I really I made so much sense out of all my experiences. I used to hate having to like be outside because people instantly look at me and I'm like, I don't want to be perceived. Can I just go to the store? Can I
Right,
just
right.
walk down the street? People are honking at me. People are telling me, stop eating,
Oh
yelling
my
at me
God.
on the street, quite literally. People are taking out their phones and holding it up and recording me while I'm outside. I'm like a spectacle, you know?
Yeah.
And I knew that the moment I made social media, that people, those same people on the streets, would be attracted to me and be without any regard
Yeah,
for my
right.
humanity because it's over through a machine. And I sort of knew that I had a high chance of going viral because I'm viral out in the world,
Oh my gosh,
I'm
right.
viral in real life because I'm stunning
Yeah.
and I
So
stun.
it's interesting, the spectacle thing you just said. I'm reading the book Sexed Up right now by Julia Serrano. I don't know if you read it. It's so delicious and blowing my mind, and I'm loving it so much. She's amazing. But she talks about like how there are people who our brains identify as marked or unmarked, meaning they read as normal or they read as notable. And when our brains, because of all the biases it does to like, the brain functions a bit lazy, right? It's like it filters out anything that's not notable. So you'll just kind of ignore stuff that doesn't conveniently fit in with whatever it's expecting. And then when you have someone who's marked, for example, a person mid-transition, they're marked because you're like, oh, I don't know what category you go in. And so people stare, right? And their brains are going like, which one is it? And likewise, all marginalized identities are marked. And she says that essentially there is this thing that happens in the world where people view you when you're marked as sort of a public spectacle. And that's why they feel so entitled. Like their brains are just more interested. That part they can't necessarily help. It's just the marked thing. But then they feel entitled to comment, entitled to whatever it might be, interact or be owed some kind of interaction because they're like, well, why would you even be out in the world as a spectacle, right? Unless it were for me to engage with. And she talks a lot about trans folks, but all of the marginalized identities are in there, and I can totally see why.
Interesting. I have always been a, well, at least since I've been, you know, a preteen, I want to say I've always been a spectacle. Even as a pretty little girl, I was a pretty little girl.
Huh.
As a pretty little girl, and that was, well, that's a whole nother conversation. I don't know if I should veer off into that. But
Your
I've
call.
always realized that a lot of eyes are on me for one reason or the other. And it, I think my parents were very aware of that. My parents are Black folks from the South who moved to California, and that's where I was originally from. And they were very hyper aware of my parents were woke in the traditional sense, pre the white
Yeah,
co-opting
yeah,
of the woke word, right? They were woke for survival purposes. They
yeah.
were born
Sure.
in the 40s in the South, Mississippi and Arkansas. Okay. So they were very hyper aware of my intersections before I w was like, my first friend was a very light-skinned black girl with blonde hair. Okay, she was a black girl with blonde hair. And every time I came home from her house as a kid, they would be like checking my body for bruises. Did you get in trouble for anything? Did they feed you? Did you get blamed for anything? They were hyper aware
Oh,
of that before I was. And it took
yeah.
me a very long time to understand, like, why are they like this? I
Yeah.
was such a Californian kid. I was like, ugh, you're talking
Yeah,
about
they're
stuff
being
that doesn't
dramatic.
make sense,
Yeah.
you know, like, stop being so, ugh, you know, like I was such a Californian kid. It took me a really long time to understand like where my parents' ex you know perspective came from,
Yeah.
and to also understand that I had been a type of spectacle too. I only grew up to be more of a spectacle over time because my body.
Sure. So for you then, choosing to go out in the world and almost like embrace the spectacle, I have to imagine, and part of this is social media, part of this is just the world, like being the representation, being the visual representation that you wanted growing up, all of that. Do you feel safe or do you do it despite not feeling safe?
That's a very good question. No, I do
Oh, no.
No, I absolutely am.
Course, I mean.
Yeah, no, I think it would be dangerous to assume my safety. I think it would be a danger to my health to assume my safety. And then also, I wanted to go back to the word embrace because I do not embrace being a spectacle. I understand why I am a spectacle.
Fair.
There, I am
Totally.
very bad at just embracing and accepting, and that I'm horrible at it, right? I really do need to understand the mechanisms that make me the thing. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool, I got it, right? So I don't embrace that I'm a spectacle. I understand how I am a spectacle.
And
And
thank you for giving that clarification because I do think it's different. And I think it's a bit harmful to presume that it's embracing a little bit of like toxic positivity language there. So I appreciate the clarification.
I never really aligned it with toxic positivity. I just know that for me, I people look at me and I'm like, I get it. I know. I got it.
So this
It's
actually
still
brings me to,
annoying.
I bet, yeah. And stressful, I'm sure.
It can be sometimes when people, like you said, they think they have access to you because, as that book described, you fall into this particular category that they're consuming you with, and so they think that they can approach you and impede on your autonomy. And I think that's the part that is most harmful, is how much carte blanche do you think that you have over my autonomy?
Totally. She also gave an example, like just to sort of highlight the point of what it meant to be marked and viewed as like the spectacle, was celebrity. Because like we can see, you know, a cat calling or like rape threats or any number of like fatphobic remarks. We can see all those things for quote unquote positive or negative, obviously. But celebrity is like almost purely sits inside of a positive space. Like, I love you. I want to take a picture with you, even though you're just writing in this coffee shop, right? Like, but it is, it's the same thing. It's because that person is so marked in our brains that we just feel like, of course, I can interrupt them. I would never interrupt another person grocery shopping or writing in a coffee shop, but this person, totally fine.
That's wild. Those experiences are the hardest. And here, I moved from California to North Carolina. I don't have a lot of those kind of experiences. People come up to me and they go, "Wow, I don't know who you are, but you like I admire what's happening." I've had those experiences since I've moved here. I don't go on, to be fair, I don't leave my apartment often. So that's a thing. In California, however, I've been like I was out and about pre-pandemic, and just at the gym is like one of the most invasive spaces a fat person can go because
Sure.
everybody wants to come and talk to you about what you're doing.
Right.
They're encouraging you, which is you just keep going and things are gonna change for you.
Proud of you.
Proud
Thanks,
of you.
stranger.
Or you could do, I've been told you can go a little harder. You can do a little bit more. Yeah. I've been told that
So unbelievably
now.
rude.
Yeah, it's so disgusting. It's so disgusting. And I think I sometimes think this would never happen to men. This would never happen to someone
Right.
assigned male at birth. Well, I would say this would never happen to men, not as someone,
Yep.
But yeah, it's not my favorite.
Yeah. So what's interesting, I lived in New York City for like a decade, and I wish I had looked as weird then as I would go on to do after I left, because the anonymity of being in a city filled with people who look whatever the F way I felt very, very marked. When I shaved my head a couple years after I left, I was like in a small town at that point, and it sucked. I mean, it was like very frustrating and stressful. It was interesting. I learned a lot as a social experiment, but I just know in New York, like if I'd gotten comments, it would have been like, oh, you look cool. And that probably would have been it. But mostly there just wouldn't have been, it just wouldn't have been notable. And I think those big cities in that way, like I'm sure, I don't know where you were in California, but
I'm from Oakland, California, and right across the bridge from San Francisco. So parts of me that weren't weird are weird now. So like people weren't shocked by my shaved head. They were shocked by my body.
Right.
Oh my gosh. Because California and bodies, the whole thing. But here in North Carolina, people are shocked by everything going on. I don't know who you are, but everything you have going on is what.
By the way, I'm in Asheville. I don't know where you are in North Carolina, but
Asheville.
Yeah,
Triad. Is that where I'm at? The Triad? Yes, the Triad.
I don't even know what that means.
I'm about 3 hours away from you.
Oh, okay, so cool.
Oh
well,
my God.
Because I was also going to say, being in the South, like bigger bodies in a place where bigger bodies are happening more often would be less marked, right? So like having a bigger body in New York City actually might be more notable to people's brains than in the South. So there is that too.
There is that. And I think two things happen, because in the Bay Area where I'm from, I could experiment more with the mini, like I have worn a mini skirt out on the street. Right. I'm getting all kinds of feedback from that. And, you know, it's all the full range. Okay. But here it would be, I haven't done that, but going out, I already, just not wearing a mini skirt or something super revealing, just going out well-dressed. And it's so interesting to see in the South how people take me in. Maybe it's just like a Southern culture thing. I have been, how do I say it? Like I've been helped with permission, right? As far as like me being a disabled person, like my disabilities aren't, maybe it's because of my age, because I am a 40 something year old woman. I don't know, but people are more willing to, can I help you with that? And I'm like, yes, absolutely can, you know? Or do you need help coming, getting up those stairs? Yes, I do. They've been more willing to take my hand.
Sure.
And I've had that experience. It's a very, some people may not like that. I have really liked that, having that experience. I didn't have that much in California.
It does feel like a Southern,
I think it is,
politeness thing too. It's like how everyone uses ma'am and sir, which drives me absolutely bonkers, but like, you know, for some people feels really cozy. Yeah.
No. And there is something saccharine sweet about the South.
Yeah.
And sometimes saccharine sweet is wrapped in covering a really ugly thing, but there is that sweetness on top of it. There is a lot of dichotomy though.
Yeah, totally.
That culture.
That's interesting. Okay. So I want to go back to this topic of body neutrality that when I first reached out to you,
I'm like, let me pull up my notes.
Yeah. Amazingly and directly, in a way that I loved and respected so much. You were like, to be honest, I don't know if I believe in body neutrality and I don't want to mislead anybody. And as we were kind of talking about it, I had understood your definition of body neutrality maybe not to be the one that I was using, and also to be something that I wouldn't necessarily be promoting. So I just wanted to ask if you happen to remember how you were conceptualizing it when I first reached out. Like, what was your understanding of body neutrality then?
I think I still have the same understanding. I think I still have the same understanding of body neutrality, that that we don't have to have a negative or positive relationship with our bodies, right? It can just be a neutral one, where bodies don't have to have positive or negative impact on ourselves, at least. And I was thinking about this leading up to this talk. I've been taking notes, because I'm like, you know, again, I am willing to be wrong. And I'm not a philosopher or I think people think I'm an activist. I don't identify as an activist.
Right, sure.
So
Yeah,
I'm not,
advocate versus
yeah,
activist, that's
advocate, yeah.
different, yeah.
And I am thinking these things through. So I'm absolutely, and I need people to make space for me to be wrong
Yeah.
about things, or at least to misunderstand things, right? And to be like, well, this is my understanding of it, you know? So I've been thinking about this quite a bit, and it's not that I don't think bodies are neutral. And it's not that I don't want them to be. I would love for them to be neutral, but that is not our experience. We do not live in a world where bodies are neutral. As a matter of fact, similar to that book, in marketing, they will tell you that one of the most easily and quickly recognized images that you could use is of a human being, because
Yeah.
we quickly categorize
Yeah, our
people. We
brains
don't
like it.
have neutral relationships with other human beings.
Yeah.
You're just not that thing. And I don't believe that I am a person that can walk around unaffected by other people. And in that sense, if someone, if I don't have a, if people aren't having a neutral relationship with me, to combat that and to have a neutral relationship with myself, it would be exhaustive. It
Yeah.
would be exhaustive, and it kind of would be a bit delusional. And not to say that delusions are something wrong that you shouldn't entertain. I love a good delusion, right? But it would be a delusion that would that I would have to exhaust myself to have to do. Here's the thing. I think the end result of body neutrality is to not have is to reduce harm.
Yeah.
I think that that and I agree with that. I do think that we can have a relationship with our bodies that is less harmful. The route of neutrality, just assuming neutrality or like trying to arrive at
Yeah.
neutrality while being bombarded by non-neutral experiences, I just don't think it's an effective route.
Okay.
I yeah,
No,
yeah.
finish it that.
I think, and I hate to take, I mean, I don't hate to take it here. I think about my parents, and I think about the wokeness prior to being
Yeah.
co-opted by, polarizing politics. Wokeness, the way my parents lived it, it was a practice.
Yeah.
It was a practice of harm reduction specifically for where their intersections landed, right? And it left out fat Black bodies, but intersectionality helped me include fat bodies into woke spaces, and queer bodies, and trans bodies,
Yeah.
non-binary bodies, into like there is a way to interact with the world where we like I said, understand the truth and understand how mechanisms,
Yeah.
systemic mechanisms, enact harm that reduces harm. And for me,
Yeah.
that helps to reduce the relationship of harm that I have with my bodies. I think I said it earlier, I have a lot of empathy for people who don't have the capacity to navigate the truth. So
Yeah.
this is going to be weird to bring up, but I think about Little Kim a lot, and people go, oh, I loved her original face. Why did she change it?
Oh,
Why did
yeah.
she change it? And I'm like, what do you mean, why did she change it? It is so much easier to be a fair-skinned person. It is so
Yeah.
much easier to be a person who is considered pretty in the world. It is
Yeah.
so much easier to reach a place where you can actualize your dreams being a person that the world mostly agrees with, right? That was harm reduction.
Yep.
That's why she changed her face. That's why people change their bodies. It
Yeah.
is so much easier to find a way to navigate the world, either being sexually attracted to, by seen by men, as sexually attractive. People are doing what the fuck they can to navigate the world in an easier way. I have
Yep.
a lot of empathy for that because marginalization and obstacles are so difficult to navigate that we kill ourselves. We unalive ourselves because of all these obstacles.
Yeah.
So I do, I don't, and for that reason, I'm not body neutral. I think that Your face is
We
like,
just agree on so much, and I want to clarify, but no,
okay,
I want you to keep
go
going.
ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So my definition of body neutrality, the way that I talk about it in the book that I wrote, Body Neutral, is it's the process of stripping away all of the moral significance and meaning that we've learned to associate with bodies so that we can see the truth at all times. It's about truth. That includes the truth of certain kinds of bodies are marginalized in our culture. If we were to ignore that, we would not be looking at the truth. And I don't know what that would be, but it would not be helpful. If we were to believe that the fact that people's bodies are being marginalized in our culture means that it's true that those bodies are worse, that also is not looking at the truth, right? So for me, it's actually probably a bit more akin to like mindfulness or, just like unresistance to reality to say a neutral lens is basically saying, A, this is how I look today. This is my body. That's a fact. B, some people are going to perceive that. It might cause me to face obstacles that, whatever. And C, they think it's because that I am somehow a worse person and deserve worse things, but I don't buy into that meaning.
Yeah.
So the neutrality, it's really about pulling apart like the meaning that's been associated with these things from the actual fact and reality of what obstacles it's definitely going to be creating or privileges it's going to be creating because other people believe that from the idea that that makes it true.
Yeah. A lot of it makes sense to me. A lot of what you just said makes a lot of sense to me. And I think where I find myself rubbing against is the piece of my belief in my worth, because there's the belief in your worth, and then there's your actual lived experience, which validates a lot of times non-worthiness, right? Because of how our world sucks that out of us, sucks the value out of our humanity, sucks the value out of, our existence, and marginalizes us based on our appearances and whatever, what have you. I don't know what rubs so hard for me around
Yeah,
that,
I'm so curious.
my belief in my worth versus what life validates for me all the time, which is my worth can be measured based on how people perceive me.
So this might be kind of a dumb question, but legitimately, do you believe that other people's measure of your worth is the same thing as your worth? Do those feel like one concept?
No, I feel like other people, they don't feel like one concept, but they feel like a concept that crosses over a lot of times,
Of course, yeah.
right? So like other people's measure of my worth don't define my worth, but they do sometimes shape my life, often, more often than
Right. Okay. Because I
not,
could
right?
actually, I would hear an argument that they were the same thing. I think it gets into like a philosophical or existential question that nobody's ever going to prove, are they the same thing or not? But like,
No.
what I'm hearing then is
And
that some
I
of,
think, I'm sorry.
no, go ahead.
ADHD makes me want to just jump out.
Please.
ADHD. Oh shit, what was I gonna say? Oh, here's the thing. I think the part of me that's rubbing together as we talk this out, because I never really talk this stuff out, is does it matter? Does it
Yeah.
matter if they're the same thing, if it's my life experience?
Right.
Right? If I just want to change my life experience, does it matter?
Yeah. So one thing I will say about that is one of the main benefits to separating them, in my mind, is that it allows you to change where you hold accountable, where accountability lives as you move through the world. For example, if you move through the world going, people bully me because I'm fat. Which makes sense because I'm making them do that with my fat body. You're holding yourself or your body accountable for other people's abusive behavior. If you are in this neutral lens, you're able to see other people's biases, which are based on falsehoods, are causing them to be abusive to me. It is not me deserving or asking for it. It's fundamentally not going to change how much abuse you get ever. It doesn't change anything about your lived experience, but there is a pretty big difference internally as you move through the world with one versus the other. So my hope for a lot of people who are able to apply this is it's about basically letting go of the shame, self-blame, and holding yourself accountable for other people being whether they're invested in some kind of discriminatory hierarchy or bias, or they're just being individualistic assholes to you. Like, either way, that you do not hold that and go, that was my fault.
I think this has caused me to have a life that is in two pieces. Like I said earlier, that I have a lot of empathy for often for the bully because I understand how systems fucked them up too, right?
Sure.
And we keep re-traumatizing
Yeah.
everyone. But when I spend time alone, I'm good with me because I know the truth.
Yes.
And when I spend time with other people who may not be able to hold conscious of the truth, I have empathy for them, but the experience is wearing. The experience is it sucks capacity,
Costly. Yeah.
right? And so I feel like I experience my life in these two worlds. Me by myself, who's no longer taking, like, as you said, the accountability for
Yep.
shame and all of this stuff that I previously internalized prior to knowing how this, how my world was really composed.
Yeah.
And now manage harm by controlling the amount of time I spend with people who don't know these things.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think because my world is separate, like, yes, a lot of my internal stuff has healed, but my relationship with other people hasn't healed. I just understand where they're coming from. And I still seek to change the experiences I have with other people. I think the danger of that, the part that is sort of like, okay, how does this really measure as harm reduction if you were to change your appearance to me to have better relationships or less
Right.
harmful relationships with the world is people, how we see each other and what we measure, how we measure each other's value fluxes all the time. So you can't keep changing yourself to accommodate the world, right? And I think that's probably where neutrality probably picks up the most speed for me is like, how do I relate to people who hate me? Right? How do I relate to people who speak death over me? Even though I know where that comes from, and I understand why it's there, and I understand that it's not the truth about my life and that we're all going to die,
Yeah.
and that because we're all going to die, you should probably be trying to spend as much sweet time with me as possible as I with you, right?
Yeah.
And if we really believe that I was going to die in a rapid space, that you would take this time to get as much gold
Yeah.
out of the situation as possible, right?
Right.
But it doesn't. It doesn't, I don't know how to neutralize the fact that people don't humanize me the
Yeah.
way I deserve to be
I don't
human.
know that you need to, honestly. Like, I don't know that you can. I don't know that you need to. Certainly not to be in a more neutral relationship with essentially neutral with your own body says, I do not believe my body makes me bad or good. It's an irrelevant factor, right? However, I don't know that there is a way to hold those things neutrally in the way that people often will imagine, which is to not have feelings about it. Like you might have your feelings less hurt if you don't believe somebody's insult, if you're just like, oh, that's factually inaccurate. But even little kids who call each other like, doo-doo heads, like they can say absolute nonsense. The other kid's feelings will be hurt despite knowing that they do not have doo-doo for a head, right? Why? Because it feels bad to have negative energy aimed at you. To have someone be cruel or at least attempt to be cruel, it feels bad. It's always going to feel bad. And I actually think that the most neutral thing we can do is accept that in the same moment, right? This is how I look today. This is how I feel about that interaction. Terrible.
Yeah. And maybe that's what we have with each other is that,
Yeah.
my parents used to call that conjure to speak over someone's life like
Call it what? Conjure? Oh, like witchcraft almost? Oh.
to speak over someone's life like that is an impact. It does
Yeah.
take it does impact you to take on these experiences that we have with each other does physically impact. So yeah,
Yeah.
I do hold that to be truth in some ways that I want to minimize that harm,
Yeah.
but and I don't know, maybe neutrality is the way. I don't know.
Yeah, I
Maybe
mean, and I
it's something cheesy like love combating it with love.
maybe, but I will say, I think that I work with all bodies. I believe that body neutrality, the way that I understand it, and with the inclusion of all of it, thoughts, feelings, preferences, you know, behaviors, all being morally neutral and welcome, that it does apply to everybody. But I also want to like fully acknowledge that I have an absolute shit ton of privilege, and I am speaking to someone who has a lot less, and I am not ever going to tell you how to move through the world. I mean, nobody really, but like in this particular dynamic, I think that's especially important to be like, I'm here learning from you. I wanted you on my podcast so my audience can learn from you, because this is an experience that is not going to often be represented, and mine is.
Yeah. And I do have that question. I do have that question, like, how neutral can multi-marginalized people be about their experience?
So in my coaching practice, what I always say is it's very possible to be neutral in the way that I've defined it, which is to say you are basically no longer holding it to be true that they are correct about you. That is possible for anyone and everyone, I believe.
Yeah.
And if you are in a multi-marginalized body, it may not materially improve your life in any notable way.
Yeah. I think
it can be liberating.
Yeah.
But it might not materially improve. And I've even worked with people, unfortunately, who I think once they started to take away the sort of fantasy of like, they were like, okay, like they're just wrong. It's not that I need to change myself, which means I'm going to stop trying or whatever, you know, whatever their journey might take them to. There is actually sometimes like getting hit with the reality that they've been hiding from by blaming themselves for a lifetime. And that can actually be so painful that they're like, to be honest, I'd rather it was my body's fault. Like, this sucks. Looking around and going, oh, so it's not my fault, but everybody hates me?
Yeah.
How is that better than it was my fault?
Yeah.
And I'm like, fair point.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know that it is.
And I think another part of my neutrality stance is the deep, deep gangsterous respect I have for strippers and sex workers who have absolutely utilized the non-neutrality of their bodies, especially Black strippers and Black sex workers who are not light-skinned, who are not racially ambiguous, to navigate structural racism in the world,
totally. And
like economic, you know, disenfranchisement in the world. They have absolutely used their body as a tool for navigating obstacles that would have harmed them. And I have a deep, teach me.
Yeah. And as do I, but it's funny because I guess I think of that as like the neutral, that like that is neutral, right? Because they looked around and went, well, if it's gonna make me money, then let's play it up, right? Or like if this is like if there's a niche for this marked part of me, or if getting surgery or procedures or any number of things is going to benefit me because that's what other people are responding to, that is just seeing the truth and making good business strategies, right? Like to me, that's neutral.
Is it?
Same as someone being like, well, is it body neutral to like wear makeup or get Botox or whatever? I'm like, there are no body neutral decisions. That's not a thing. The whole point is that they're all morally neutral.
I got neutrality messed up. I definitely thought they were body neutral decisions.
And I think that's a really common way of looking at it. And in fact, like maybe a reason I should name it something else, if I'm being perfectly honest, it's a very, very common one. But I think like essentially being able to say, you could do the most intense, invasive, you could get a brand new face and body if you had the money and the time and the interest, right? But there are two ways that that could happen. One is you look around and go, that aligns with the truth that I see and understand. And it is a decision I'm making from a conscious place for some reason. It gets me something I want. It helps me avoid something I don't want. You could also do it in the hopes that because you believe your current face or body makes you so unworthy of love and respect, so bad, so fundamentally wrong, that you are hoping to earn your own approval or to get to a place where you know, there are other ways of doing it. that don't feel very good and I wouldn't wish upon anyone. And yeah. then there are ways of doing it that are just badass empowered decision making. So it's yeah. not about the decisions, right? To me, it's very much like if you can get to a neutral place, you're able to make that conscious decision. That's going to get me the job I want.
Well, Jesse, so. This was a very fruitful.
Oh, I'm so glad. Okay, well, we do have to wrap up here. So Brina, could you tell people where to find you, how to work with you, yeah. all of that?
Absolutely. You can visit my website at www.brinajean.com. You can follow me on Instagram and TikTok at thebrinajean.com. That's thebrinajean. And I am available for public speaking, storytelling, and collaborations such as this one here.
I love it. Everyone, go follow Brina. We will include your links in the show notes and all of that kind of stuff. I'm a huge fan, and this was a fabulous conversation. So thank you so much.
I'm a very like big fan of yours now. I would love to come to Asheville. And
oh my gosh, please do. It's a fantastically queer city. Talk about marked and unmarked. Like gender has just become unmarkable here. Like everywhere I go, I feel like I see really unique gender expressions, and it makes me very happy. So I don't know where you are, but
I'm very curious.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you to everyone who's listening. Thank you to Brina for being here. And I will catch everyone next episode. Hey, everyone. I'm Jesse Neeland, and I want to take a moment to thank you for listening to this episode of the This Is Not About Your Body podcast. I put out new episodes every Tuesday, so be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss it. And if you really enjoyed it, please go ahead and leave me a review. Also, if you're looking for more information about body neutrality or you want to work with me, you can find me at my website, jessenealand.com. Or you can just purchase my book, Body Neutral, A Revolutionary Guide to Overcoming Body Image Issues, wherever you buy books, ebooks, or audiobooks. We can also connect on Instagram or TikTok. My handle is Jesse Neeland. And because I make this podcast available for free and without any sponsors or ads, you can also feel free to show your support using the Patreon link in the show notes. And know that your support, if you decide to participate, is always very much appreciated. Lastly, thank you to my brother, Jason Neeland, for creating the music that plays at the beginning of the show. And thank you for listening, learning, and moving toward personal and collective body liberation.